Our topic is on the board here. Who do you know? And know is spelled N-O, which means who do you negate, rather than who do you know, K-N-O-W. It's going to deal with breaking some of the barriers as far as communication is concerned. My material comes from a manuscript in progress, so it's a little difficult. Hey, there is a seat right in the middle here, too. So I've taken this with me, and I didn't know I was going to be involved, so I'll share a little bit from some of this material at hand. When we think about problems of communication, I'm reminded of the Conciliation Court in Gallatin County of Montana, where they studied their records for a one-year period. They were trying to find out and identify the most common problem experienced by married couples. The number one problem was, quote, lack of communication. In 88% of their court cases, couples didn't or couldn't talk over their problems at home. So that's one approach to the topic of communication. There's still a seat up here, if you wish one. Then think about the English language. Anybody know approximately how many words we have in the English language? Guess? No? 600,000. 500 of the most frequently used words have a total of 14,000 dictionary definitions. Now, when you think about that, that's an average, not mean every one, but an average of 28 definitions for the 500 most commonly used words in the English language. Now, how do we ever communicate on that basis? Normally, you know, we think that words have meanings, but actually, you and I have a meaning for whatever symbol or word we might have used. Let's think of some samples here. For example, I've got one over here, and maybe some of you can help me as I move along or tell me afterwards. It would be a good idea. I don't know quite how to illustrate this. I have what I call a basket here. The label on the basket is the word shot. Now, I have listed on the top only six of the definitions. There are a total of 37 definitions in the dictionary for the word shot. I have here what? Hostile remark, gun discharge. Do I mean a photo? Are we talking about an object for shot putting? A shot in the dark? Or a hypodermic injection? Plus 31 others. So you can see a few of the challenges that we face when we are just working with our plain old English language. And so if some of you are artists and have a better concept and can maybe tomorrow or tonight tell me how I might get the idea of a word being a container of some type in which there are many definitions from which we can draw, why, this would be helpful, and I'll appreciate your assistance on that. A few other words that might kind of surprise you. The word table in the dictionary has 24 definitions in an unabridged dictionary. Come, 52. Lead, 69. Cut, 83. And run, 172. So you see, we have a challenge in communicating even before we kind of get our first words out. Okay, now we're going to move to the idea of who do you know. After that introduction, of all the people that you know, who do you know, N-O, the most? Who do you negate the most?
My grandchildren.
Your grandchildren would be one topic. Anybody else have a feeling who you might negate the most?
My husband.
Your husband. I don't think I'll touch that with a 10-foot pole. But, all right, your husband. Who else might we negate the most?
My
Myself.
Myself, Gene says. That's what I was looking for. Think about it. You know, unless you are maybe different than the two of us anyway, we might be negating ourselves the most of anyone else. Okay, so now I've got the question. Well, okay, here's a picture. This is my artwork. That's Ken Erickson, huh? In front, I have something else. Here is kind of a not too happy face. You know, that's me. Out here, what do I project?
Smile.
I call this what? What would I call this thing? Facade. Yeah, a mask. Some call it various things, but we'll use the word facade because that indicates more than just a mask. A little bigger than that. So I look over here and say, why do I, or why do you, why would someone else carry a facade?
Because you want to be liked.
Okay, good. We want to be liked.
Because you're insecure?
I'm insecure, yeah. And I'm fearful that I may not be liked the way I am. A little statement by John Powell illustrates this. I am afraid to tell you who I am, because if I tell you who I am, you may not like what you see, and it's all I have. So we hide behind facades for various reasons. And I've got the first comment up here. It says, Auntie Michael's influence. When I was a boy, we lived 39th in Portland and 40th, right neighbor behind us, Auntie Michael. Very fine, friendly, competent. You know, she used to bake cookies and give us. We liked Auntie Michael very much. But when I was not the type, my behavior was not what my parents wished, you know what I would hear? Yeah, what will Auntie Michael think? Anybody else heard that when they were children? Yeah, a few of you have. What will Auntie Michael think? Now, it also can be, what will grandmother think of you? What will the teacher think of you?
And the neighbors.
What will the neighbors think of you? What will the pastor think of you? And what are they really saying to me about myself when they make that comment?
You're inadequate.
What?
You're inadequate.
I'm inadequate. I'm not what they think I should be. Therefore, I should be different than what I am there, huh? And so I need to have something that they can look at that is acceptable to them in that situation. So what happens? I hear that after a while. And I need to have, you know, maybe I've got to make it a little bigger, huh? So that they don't really see the me that is there. And I hear it more often, you know, and maybe I've got to make it a little thicker after a while. Like, you know, you can get 3-ply veneer and 5-ply and what, 8, 10-ply veneer? It gets thicker and thicker because of that need. In other words, they're saying, in effect, you're not okay as you are. Be something different. So to satisfy, you know, I might tend to build something that they would like to see. So we hide behind facades for various reasons. There's another thing than Auntie Michael. Kind of the family and society expectations for, and I can only talk for boys, because that's what it was, only experience I have. But I think it's kind of damaging sometimes. I think maybe it comes from the Northern European countries, though there are always exceptions within and around situations. But I would hear, boys don't cry. So if I had feelings and emotions, I was not to let them out. The philosophy was that, you know, kind of supported then by movies and all that at the time. Who did we see? The tough Lone Ranger, Zorro, All these people would not flinch under problems. And I think boys were conditioned to admire the rugged individualists who appear to be self-reliant, emotionally in control at all times. So I was, again, I guess, you know, having to make another layer of a different type. And that was an emotional layer. An emotional layer. Because if I felt like crying, that wasn't what boys did at that time. Anybody else have any comments in that area? Am I off base? Is that on target for some people or not? Okay, that I appreciate that because that kind of reinforced what we heard from mom and dad and society. And the expectation is there. Okay, a little spin-off on that. A friend who was here and is not here now. We were talking about the fact that my wife and I had gone ahead and arranged, made funeral arrangements, you know, and we got our plot someplace and we've got their name on the thing, all except the final dates, you know, we've taken care of that. So I talked to him and said, you know, what about you? Well, he said, and he is a stalwart Scandinavian. You know, if you ever saw a stalwart Scandinavian, he is one. He said, well, I don't think I want my wife to have a funeral, not even a memorial service. And I said, why? Well, he said, I would blubber. You know, they could hear me sobbing all over. And that's not what, that's, you know, he would have to drop the shield and be a human being. Now, that's just another example, I guess, of what I'm trying to stress here. Can you think of anything that the church does that might be unhelpful in relation or might help me want to carry a facade or help you or someone else carry a facade to shield from what you really are? Is there anything that happens in church that might be that way?
They don't want you to be who you are.
All right, one statement.
They are paranoid about me being handicapped. They don't think that I don't know what I'm doing.
Okay, so they don't understand, and they want you to be something a little different.
Yes.
Okay, that's one good idea, one good helpful idea here.
What about the idea that we have to be perfect?
Yeah. Did that come from up here again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, what are the expectations of church members?
That you be a perfect man, boy, or girl.
Uh-huh, yeah, or an adult. And I remember when some families would walk into church on Sunday morning when we were in Portland, mother, father, dressed just every hair in the right place, children the same way, and they'd march in, you know, in a row like that, and they'd get in their row pews, and I'll sit there, you know, like this. What did the other family say? What's wrong with us? Look at that. They had the front, you know, a beautiful front out here. I'm not saying it wasn't a good family, anything of that nature. But let me read something that, part of what, this is a quote from Paul Tournier, who I recommend highly if you don't know Paul Tournier, his works. A nagging question persists to which I need an answer. Paul Tournier claims that it is when individuals are well-educated, have the highest ideals, and, quote, should know better, that they are the most ashamed of their behavior and do all they can to hide it. Now, Paul Tournier, Swiss psychiatrist and man of God also, says that knowing what we are, we may tend to hide what, you know, our real selves in church. Are some of us plagued by Apostle Paul's plight, that which I would not I do, and that which I would I do not? I'm one of those that's plagued that way, you see. Is it possible that those of us who are church members have high personal goals and ideals, and we feel a greater need to hold up a facade? to hide some of our inadequacies. One of the best groups I think that my wife and I have ever been involved with, well, it was helpful anyway. We held it in our home. We called it the Strugglers Group. And we had probably, there were about four couples, I think, younger people at church. We sat down, and I guess we were using either Paul Tournier or who was it, Loie? Keith Miller, yeah. And in that situation, Lois and I could say, you know, well, we had this type of a problem, from starting from small things like, I'm a toothpaste tube roller, and she's a scruncher. You know, when we got married, there's the cap was thrown away. Can you believe that? And the toilet paper, you know, that's supposed to come off with a roll toward the wall, huh? And she had it the other way. Well, from little things on up. And you could see the other people kind of say, you know, well, but, you know, you have these concerns and you got problems, you know, you're human. We thought it was just us because, you know, you look like this in church. And I think we can benefit a great deal from small groups where we are honest with each other and where we do not carry our facades. Any comments? Yes.
What about the church's expectation of the pastor?
Oh, I feel sorry. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Yeah. Unrealistic.
Well, some have that he's supposed to be way up here. He never gets angry and says a bad word.
Not supposed to be human.
Gentlemen and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't always work that way.
No, I feel sorry for them. And in Europe also it was, in Germany anyway, Herr Preston. You know, I mean, no, but you bow to them even. And I think I had a questionnaire one time for our pastors. What is it that congregational members can do that will be more helpful? What do they do that's unhelpful? What can they do that's helpful? And one was, accept me as a sinner, forgiven son of God, you know, citizen of God's kingdom or something like that. I'm glad you brought up that point because we almost build a facade for them, a facade of our expectations, which is not necessarily fair at all. Different standards. Okay. Anything else that you want to add before we move on to the next point? The next point is, you know, what are the costs of facade bearing, carrying, or whatever we want to call it? What's the price, the challenge that's involved for you? Anybody have any comments you want to make on that? Any feelings? Yes.
Well, what you see of everyone else is their facade, but what you know about yourself is how you really exist. So I think you tend to feel poorly about yourself.
Yeah.
As a result of that. You think everyone else seems better organized or more centered or more used to themselves than you are, but you see their facade.
So one of the costs may be that we cut ourselves down or looking at ourselves and we kind of think others have a lot of these problems solved, which is not necessarily true. Nathaniel Hawthorne said, "No man can for any considerable time wear one face to himself and another to the multitude without finally getting bewildered as to which one is true." I think when Carol Hinderly was here, he made the comment that if we always pay attention to what other people say about us, we become a little Sir Echo. You know, echo of what you think is right and what you think is right, and pretty soon, you know, I'm cutting myself apart and there isn't much left of me as an individual.
I think mothers have that when you're young and you have a family and you have to be a wife and then you have to be a mother and you are always being these other things and you're never yourself. Your wants, your desires, they're not as important as everybody else's.
Mm-hmm. You play role A, role B, role C, and so on, and you kind of have to subjugate yourself to everybody else's wishes. So you can't be yourself in that regard.
Young women nowadays have got some kind of a handle on that, but I don't know if that's what they're doing is good
here. Uh-huh. Okay.
Because okay. The result of losing yourself, you also maybe you start to play games.
We play games when we kind of lose
Your sense ourselves. Of
self. Yeah. Well,
and
pretty soon, years ago, wasn't there a permanent wave, the Tony? Which twin has the Tony?
Yeah.
You know, I might think, you know, which Ken is the phony? And so I probably get this shell bigger and better all the time. Okay, cost of facade bearing, a couple other things. The building of a facade places us in a double bind. The more consistently I hold up a facade, the less others know the real me, and the less I know my real self. Nothing is more exhausting than being insincere. It's only confusing, or it's also confusing to everyone when I use different facades in different settings. Maybe what the mother has to do. At any given moment, it becomes a challenge to distinguish between what I really am and the facade that is set up to gain your approval. When seeming to be something else becomes more important than being, I have developed friends of my facade, not my real self. Some authorities claim that I can understand only as much of myself as I am willing to communicate to another. Does it follow that I eventually could become a stranger to myself? We all need at least one person, Paul Tournier says, to whom we can really be open and honest. I guess it would be an error to suggest that we're going to go around and, you know, show my warts or whatever it is to everybody, huh? But we all need some individual or individuals where we can be our true selves.
I don't think that is only the case. I know somebody that I don't know him. I mean, I've been with him for 30 years. I don't know him. Every time I see him, he's someone different.
That's interesting.
I mean, he is so much.
So many different people?
Diverse. Yeah.
Okay.
I think he is paranoid to know who he is himself.
Okay. A good point. Some friend who you've known for 30 years and you're not sure if he knows who he is, and you certainly don't know who he is, okay? We got this point here. How do we strengthen another person's facade? Let's say that I've got a facade, you've got a facade. What can I do that might strengthen your facade, make you want it to have it stronger? That would be taking down. What might I do to make you want to make yours bigger?
Okay,
it's all right.
Rejecting that person?
Or agree with them.
What?
Agree with them.
Agree with them? That might help. I'm saying what might hurt. Yes.
I might admire the qualities they're projecting as their facade.
That would be one way, I think. So what if I... Pardon?
Reject what is their true self. Reject what is their true self.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. If I reject, I'm critical. Let's say I'm critical of you. And you want my friendship. And you want me to admire you and like you, see? Maybe you make it thicker or try to put another front on that I might like. That's what I was kind of driving at when I said, how do we strengthen another's facade? And this may help a little bit. When I feel inadequate, I am tempted to point out some weakness of yours. Now, that sometimes is a natural reaction. Just to make myself feel better. Open constructiveness, however, does not allow judgment of another person. When I do so, if I'm judging you, I reveal my own immaturity. By trying to change you rather than accepting you where you are, I have ruined the possibility that you might lay down your facade because you probably need it even more so. I may have encouraged you to strengthen it on that basis. Does that ring bells? Is that okay? Okay, let's go ahead. We'll try to get through so we have some more time for more input from you. I've got the question there, do youth need facades? What's your feeling about that? Do they need masks and facades and fronts?
With some people, I feel that way. But not all people.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about the adolescents and such? Yeah.
I think they need them the most because the peer pressure is the greatest when they're teenagers. They have to perform, you know, up to snuff, and they have high school groups, you know, and they have to all wear the same clothes, and they have to, you know, I think it'd be very strong for adolescents.
Yeah. It seemed to be, conforming is a good word. I remember, I think we used to have to wear freshman tin pants and sophomores wore cords and I think junior, I don't know what it was, but, or the certain type of shoes. What about the Levi's or the, you know, jeans today? Wow, yeah, hairstyles too. Very important part.
I think the cult in our society, you know, youth need to have facades because we tend to isolate that group. They're a minority. They're neither children nor adults. And so they have to create all these facades to cope.
They're interestingly enough, they have the facades to cope with each other or to be a part of the group and also kind of to keep out some of us. If you read a book, or there's an interesting book on teenage slang and how it moves across the country and how it changes, and some of the things that they say, and they're not meant only just to be in with their group, but it's also kind of meant to keep the adults or parents out of their conversation. Okay, we talked mainly about parents so far. Let's look a little bit at the youth. Belonged to LCA, and we had a Pacific Northwest Regional Conference several months ago. And there was a youth convocation at the same time. One of their activities was to divide into small groups, and each of these small groups to write a verse to a song that would describe their feelings in a new and unknown situation. Of course, that's kind of tough for any of us to be in a new and unknown situation. But that was their challenge. And this is, they titled what they wrote, Here's One for the Outcast. And I just have a couple of verses and a chorus here, but this is one. I was feeling scared. I was feeling unwanted. I was feeling like going home. If only they knew the real me. End of the first verse. You can just see the facade there. Second, I felt as if I were lost, as if I had no friends around. I was afraid to share my feelings, my genuine feelings. I didn't want to be found. Again, you can almost see that. I felt left out and unhappy, uncomfortable and out of place. I felt like going back home, back to some secure place. And the chorus they wrote, Here's one for the outcasts. They're living life the best they can. I wonder who makes them outcasts. Let's open our arms and let them in. Youth need facades? Apparently they do. No youth or adult can develop freely and find meaning in life without feeling understood by a minimum of one person. That again comes out of Paul Tierney's thinking. If they don't find such a person within the family of God, they will find such a person outside the family of God. I'd like to emphasize that because they may not be our children, you know, our blood and flesh, but if they're in our church, how many of you spend time talking with, recognizing, appreciating, whatever, the youth in your church? You know, do they have some friends of all ages? They're a lot of fun. They're a lot of fun. And I'm fortunate to have some good friends in that age group. So I'd like to encourage that, I guess, as far as the rest of you are concerned. Okay, if we were going to suggest that we dropped our facades, I'm assuming that you all have a mask of some type that you wear sometimes. if we said, hey, let's everybody drop it, what would be the result? How would you feel?
Naked.
Naked. It's a good word. So, what?
You'd hang loose.
And that's kind of opposite of being uptight, isn't it?
Alone.
Might feel alone, okay? Might feel alone. Would you feel differently after a while, or what do you mean?
No, I think we'd feel release.
Release. Okay, because you saw me as I am, as well as I see you as you are. Uh-huh.
Depend a little bit upon how the other person or persons accepted you if you dropped your baton.
Oh, yeah. I guess what I was hoping for is that we might say 1, 2, 3, drop. It's a little unrealistic, I think, but in, you know, again, with a friend or with several close friends, we might be able to, and that's probably going too far. You know, maybe we can say, okay, let's reduce our facade. You know, next time maybe this is it, and maybe we'll make a little more inroads here, and so on, until there are at least some holes in here. Maybe they serve a purpose, but they can be a disservice to us also.
Wouldn't it make relationships more appreciative, though, like it?
I don't know. Think so? Make more abrasive relationships?
I think we feel that we should be rather polite in dealing with one another. You have to know a person, I think, quite well before we really take away that.
Yeah. I guess what I'm thinking of, and I'm not clear on this, but I guess I'm thinking that I'm not going to be at all judgmental of you. I mean, that would not be the purpose, to be abrasive and judgmental and say, oh, I see you've got a problem here. That. If you're going to accept me, then I'm going to have to accept you, each of us as we are. And then again, if God accepts us as we are, maybe that's the model that we try to follow. I find it easy to be judgmental. I don't like to make all these confessions, but...
I'm thinking that you dropped it, that you would find out that you're this miserable creature in here, after all, you could make a new facade.
That's possible, but you see, behind all this, for me anyway, is the growing realization, and I learned slowly, that if I am acceptable in the place that counts the most, if I'm acceptable to God as I am, maybe I don't have to be quite so worried about what someone else might say or think. And for me, pride gets in the way. You know, that's what part of it. Yeah.
Well, I find as I deal with people, the more I know about them, especially if they have a problem, it seems like you can get closer to them.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you can see inside there and see what that person is really like.
Good.
And then you can like them.
I
have a Mexican friend who has a real facade, you know. She says, everybody hates her. And I said, you know what's the matter with you? I said, you're the one that's putting up the facade, because mm-hmm. most people don't care that much.
Yeah, you're so right, I think, in that area. If we really understand somebody,
yeah.
we're closer to them. Mm-hmm. And I give one quick example. A fellow who was dean of a medical school in another state, and I was at a seminar with him. It was one of those where we're trying to get to know each other, know ourselves better, and so on. And I found out I kind of resented him, because we get in a group discussion, and he had looked like he had the world by the tail, you know, everything was under control.
Oh, yeah.
And he kind of took over and what do you think about this, and so on, and I was resenting this somewhat. Then about the second or third day, there's a summit going on, and he made some statement. The leader said, well, how would you feel if you said this is what you should do, and all of your staff said we don't want to go another direction, do something else? Oh, he said, that'd be all right. And the leader was more perceptive. He said, now, wait a minute. If you really are committed to something and other people object, do you really feel good? And the guy broke down crying. This, you know, strong fellow broke down crying. Well, my heart changed immediately, as you suggest. And he is one of my best friends to this day. I appreciate it. I understood. He was human. And I guess when we have a non-human mask that people can't believe, it's like, in my thinking, trying to pick up a greased bowling ball that has no holes drilled in it. You can't get a hold of somebody. But what I know, well, I know too, when I work different places, when I really find out the problems that somebody has, I'm amazed they're doing as well as they can. So I think openness and honesty can help us in that regard. Okay, we're time. I'm watching the time because I know the bell will ring at 10:02. Is that right for Vespers or? So. Okay, George Eliot wrote one time, this is on dropping facades. Oh, the comfort, the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh thoughts or measure words, but to pour them all out just as they are, chaff and grain together, knowing that a faithful hand will take and sift them, keeping what is worth keeping, and the breath, and with the breath of kindness, blow the rest away.
I can't resist this. Probably a lot of people know that George Eliot was a woman.
Marion Evans, yeah.
Now, the facade that people who are experts in literature say that, and I didn't use the word facade, but said that was necessary when this person lived, or her writings would not have been accepted. It's just one of those ironies.
Possibly. That's good. And that's
happened.
See, maybe she knew more about the facades and the problems thereof than someone who didn't have to.
I agree the words that you, they're marvelous. Mm-hmm. That's insight. But here's the facade.
Yeah. Well, apparently she had to do that in order to get published. Is that your point?
Well, that's what experts in literature say.
Well, that leaves me out, but I'll buy it. That sounds all right, yeah. Okay, let's move ahead a little bit to how do we know others? Because we've really been talking about how we know ourselves. Now, how might we know others? And let's see here, a couple of opening comments. Get into the light here. The Chinese, when they want to punish a person, hold court and declare that person dead. After the proclamation, no one in the village speaks to the person again, or I should say spoke, I do not know if this is true now, spoke to the man again or had anything to do with him. Before long, the victim wandered away and died by himself. Because others were, in a sense, knowing that individual. Some churches have been known to what? Excommunicate individuals? That would be an official act of a church. Is it possible that in our own parishes anyone is ever excommunicated unofficially?
The Amish have shunning.
Ah, yes.
If someone isn't acting the way they think an Amish person should act, or isn't believing the way, then they shun him or her.
The Amish would shun a him or a her, and...
And we can do that in our congregation.
But yes. That's the type of official act. That edict goes out.
Mm-hmm. I think Edna's point probably is, it's just as effective on me if it's official or unofficial.
Right.
I could be, shunned that way. There are no numerous ways of unofficially excommunicating or shunning people. Maybe a simply to belittle them, to ridicule them, to laugh at them rather than laugh with them, to be thoughtless. How many people are avoided in your congregation? Mm. George Bernard Shaw said that the worst sin toward our fellow creatures is not to hate them, but to be indifferent to them. Mm. That's the essence of inhumanity. And we don't always see this because, well, I guess one place in our church I can see it. Lorraine is blind. Someone brings Lorraine to church. After church, I look around and, you know, maybe someone's talked to her and left, and she's standing, you know, somewhere holding on to something all by herself. I think we have a good church. And I think maybe some person probably says, if I go up and talk to Lorraine, maybe no one else will come and talk, and I'll be there the rest of the time. I don't know. You know, but that's a thought they might have. Then I think of a fellow whose first name was Dave. Came to our church, now it must be 5 months ago. I don't know what a street person really looks like today, but he had long hair and a beard, and it did not necessarily fit the apparel pattern that we had in our congregation. I don't know how many others talked to Dave. He stood by himself in the coffee hour for a while, and I went up and talked to him once. He never came back. Is that, you know, we can shun people by doing nothing in our churches, in our congregations. Yes.
I know a guy who became a Buddhist after not being able to be, he could not do anything. And they didn't show him the hymn book.
In church?
Yeah. And he got really upset with the Christian church and became a Buddhist.
So there's a case of a fellow who felt so left out and left alone that he left or did not come anymore to church and became a Buddhist. Yeah. Where apparently they cared enough to help him out.
Yeah.
Okay, that's another example which is real and can be very helpful to us. I'll get back to churches, but I want to touch a little bit on families for a minute. As a dinner guest in a home, I cringe sometimes when I hear the host husband broadcast. And this is a fellow, very capable, very competent, who is very positive in his comments about the employees and the organization and all that. But I hear him say, well, Martha never could bake a very good pie. Wow, a zinger. I wince when a wife laughs with disdain or consistently butts in to correct her husband's comments. I worry when someone continually interrupts another person or ignores the personal interests of a family member. And then what about children? How do parents know their children? Laughing at a child, particularly those seeking some attention, can be devastating. I shrink at how some parents treat their children in public. In a supermarket, you can hear some parent broadcast for everyone to hear, put that back, stupid, before I bust you one. The biggest no of all in my mind for a child is the impression that his parents think he or she is untouchable. We had some good sessions on touch here earlier this week. You know, where one child in one family sits in father's lap or mother's lap much of the time, just contented to be there while the paper's being read or whatever. And another child in another family may never remember sitting in a parent's lap. And what type of an impression, you see, is received by the child in that situation? We have what some people call a high-tech, low-touch society. Okay, we're moving kind of slowly here. A little more on churches for a minute. I think about being able to know a person you know, pastor and an organist in a church in Oregon, that's close, I want to come, were having kind of a feud. I mean, they did not see eye to eye. The Sunday finally, or when this Sunday occurred, that the pastor announced he had received a call and nothing special happened. And then he announced that he had accepted the call. The organist broke in immediately, full volume, "Praise God from whom all blessings flow." That's public knowing, I guess. But usually our problems in church come from acts of omission rather than commission that we just talked about. I don't think we don't ever have a meeting and say, you know, we're going to exclude so-and-so. You know, they're different or whatever. But corporately, how do strangers see us when they come to visit? Lois, yeah, we might be God's frozen people, someone said. Lois and I have been to a number of churches, and you know, some places, nobody says boo. They all go to talk to their own friends afterwards, and we feel knowed in that situation. I had a very opposite experience, and it was such a fine one that I want to share it with you, unless you might want to take it home. I was in Victoria, British Columbia about a year ago, and I think it was an Anglican church. It was quite a large church, and they had quite a few visitors, as they would have there. But part of the morning was to have each visitor stand and tell their name and where they were from. Now that doesn't happen. I haven't seen that very often. Well, that was one act that was positive. But then later, when they were singing the last hymn, the choir members, all in their red surpluses, is that surplus, is that the right word? Whatever it is, aprons. Anyway, they marched during the last hymn from the front, down the aisle, and if this is the back of the church, and let's say there were three doors, exits here, they lined up about 4 feet apart, all across the back of the church. You couldn't get out of there if you wanted to, without somebody greeting you and, you know, talking to you for a little while. I don't know if that will work other places, but to me it was quite interesting. And then a word I want to put in here about post-funeral loneliness and knowing people. Loneliness, then, I think is kind of an acute disease caused by psychological stress that's kind of bruising. One friend said to me that Sunday is a family day, and she was quite sure that there would be people calling on her and her mother. A friend was with her. I guess the mother was with her because the father had passed away, that's right. Thought there would be people calling on her, and they sat around all Sunday afternoon, all alone, waiting, waiting, waiting. She says, "We waited all afternoon for someone to come. It was a letdown. Nothing happened." After that, a number of friends said to her, same thing, "We knew you would have a lot of company in the afternoon, so we didn't come." We have our excuses for inaction. And then, how often do we deny members in God's family the appreciations that they are due? And in effect, I think we're knowing them because we're ignoring them. And there are so many people around here who do a lot of things. And I don't know if they ever get our appreciation. You know, if your pastor may have worked hard to develop a new Lenten program, or the choir may have outdone itself in preparing for Easter, the Sunday school teachers faithfully work and plan all the time, and these people urgently need some yesing, some affirmation, rather than ignoring. But we slight them by doing nothing again. A friend of mine in another church commented but their pastor never said anything in the way of a positive appreciation. And finally, someone on the board went and talked to him about this. And the pastor's response is, well, yeah, I know these people do that, but God knows. Hey, I'm sure he does. But what is wrong with following, what is in Proverbs, if there's anything, no, I guess in Philippians, anything good, anything positive, anything of good report to think on these things? And Proverbs 27:3 has something like that. Well, final error. The calling of being contagious for Christ falls on every single member. Where we live, where we work, where we play. Thinking of those whom we contact daily, those for whom we have some accountability, we might, if we listen carefully, hear Jesus say to each of us by name, put your own name in here, Ken, or whoever, who do you know? And it's a little switch from our common thinking of, do you know the right people? I have 10 to, I haven't heard a bell. A what?
5 till.
5 till. We got a few minutes for your comments. Please. Anybody?
One thing you haven't touched on is, I think so much of the reason for a lot of our personality facades is fear of being hurt.
Okay. Fear of being hurt would be a reason for having this barrier.
It holds people at a distance.
No. Okay. And one of those layers could be humor, couldn't it? You make a funny remark.
It could be
ridicule.
Anything, you know, but okay. It reinforces that need to protect ourselves from being hurt. And I think sometimes the more sensitive the person, the bigger the front.
Yeah. The more sensitive
thicker
we are,
friendly.
The thicker, yes. Okay?
I agree with being caring and thoughtful about other people's hurts and so forth. But I think there's good in a facade for me personally. If I can put on a smile when I'm hurting inside, I feel I begin to live up to the smile that I have and feel better myself. Other people will feel better because I'm smiling rather than down in the mouth and complaining about and letting it all hang out about where I'm hurting and how I'm hurting. I think sometimes the facade works for good.
Okay, we have that point, and we'll probably have to close on that. Well, thank you for your participation.